The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
And we'll break in here at verse 10. Notice that Paul has said in verse 9 that you are not to lie to one another, seeing that you have put off apekdousomenoi, the old man, with his practices, and now verse 10, and have put on the new, that is, the new man, who is being renewed anakainoimenon, that new man who is being renewed unto epinosis, unto knowledge, according to the icon, according to the image of the one who created him. Now look over also earlier in the canon at the very similar statement in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 24. Here's where Paul has said in verse 20, look at verse 20, but you did not so learn Christ. That's not the way you learned Christ. And the way you have learned Christ, verse 22, is that you put off that old man, ton palaion anthropon, and now coming to verse 24, to put on the new man, ton kainan anthropon, that new man who, kata theon, according to God, has been created, katisthentha, has been created in righteousness and holiness of the truth. Or perhaps you would want to translate true holiness, true righteousness and true holiness. Now some seem to suggest that these verses define directly that condition in which Adam found himself before the fall. But you see, these verses are a definition not directly of Adam's situation before the fall, but rather they're a direct definition specifically of the new man in Christ. And it has to be affirmed, I think, that Christ does not merely restore us to our original condition, but he brings us to a final glory above anything that Adam knew. And we might want to express that by saying that Christ, the second Adam, brings his people to that state of perfected and confirmed, never-ending and complete knowledge, righteousness, and holiness, which Adam would have attained had he perfectly fulfilled that demand for obedience placed upon him in the original covenant. Others seem to want to suggest that the blessings of Christ go even beyond this, although what that beyond might be, I think, would be hard to imagine. Unless perhaps it be the experienced wonder of grace abounding in the forgiving and conquering of sin, which is something that man would never have known in the same way, at least, had God's original command been obeyed. So I'm saying, first of all, that it would not be accurate to say that Colossians 3:10 and Ephesians 24 give us kind of directly a definition of the original situation of man. But nevertheless, as John Laidlaw writes, and I quote, "While the creation of grace is thus the only direct subject of affirmation in both these passages, the language fairly implies that man was originally constituted in a divine image, of which righteousness and holiness in truth or knowledge were essential features." I think on the basis of the language of Colossians 3:10 especially, notice the language there, kata kana tu kitisantas eltan, according to the icon of the one who created man. Although the reference in Ephesians 4:24 to creation according to God, tan katathion kitisantha, is also no doubt intended as a purposeful, conscious allusion back to Genesis 1:26, 27. I think on the basis especially of the language of Colossians 3:10, but also of Ephesians 4:24, that Laidlaw's conclusion that although it's not the direct subject here, there's an indirect reference back to the original creation of man. I think that conclusion of Laidlaw is a fair and a defensible conclusion. And the point is, you see, of all this, that once we define the divine image in terms of, this is what the divine image means, knowledge, righteousness, true holiness, well, then it becomes evident that fallen man no longer is the divine image. Fallen man no longer possesses the divine likeness, if that's what the divine likeness means. And therefore, he must be renewed in the image of God. It's not something he has, it's something that he needs to be renewed in. To listen to Laidlaw again, when we content ourselves with the assertion that this description of the new man presupposes corresponding outlines in the first man, which were broken off and blurred by sin, and which are now for the first time fully realized in man redeemed and renewed, then a sound exegesis will bear us out. In Laidlaw? It's pages 106 and 107. The problem is, my edition is the original edition, and the one in the library is the new edition, and page references. Pardon? Oh, okay. Okay, if you can get hold of the original edition, it's pages 106 and 107. You'll find it in the other one fairly easily. You know, it's pretty obvious where it's going to appear there, where he's dealing with those texts, where he's dealing with the question of the image. Okay, secondly, or small b now, still looking at the text that seemed to tell us that fallen man is no longer the image of God, notice how the New Testament reveals that it's by the process of redemption, regeneration, sanctification, and glorification, it's by that whole process of salvation in Christ that man attains the image of God. And that's explicitly stated, it would seem, in Romans 8:29. Very familiar verse to us, but just to make sure it's making an impression upon us, it's probably well to turn it up. In Romans chapter 8, at verse 29, where we read, "For those whom God foreknew, he also predestinated, sumorphos tes ikados tu huiu eltu." To be conformed, you see, to the icon, the image of his Son. Now, the Son, of course, is the image of God par excellence. To say that the goal of salvation is conformity to the image of Christ is not to introduce some new notion, it seems to me, in contrast with man being the image of God, because Christ is that image of God in bodily form even, par excellence. Just think about Colossians 1:15. Colossians 1:15 and 2 Corinthians 4:4, where God has revealed himself, revealed his glory, his doxa, in the face of Jesus Christ, that way in which Paul puts it in 2 Corinthians 4:4. And Hebrews 1:3, icon doesn't appear there, or doxa, but still the idea seems to be there in Hebrews 1:3. Therefore, the implication of Romans 8:29 is that man in his fallen state does not possess this image. He must be conformed to it. That's the goal of salvation. And then thirdly, or small c, perhaps this also is the fact that fallen man does not possess the image. He needs to be renewed in it. Perhaps this is more of an exegetical question on this text, but perhaps this is the fact that Paul alludes to in Romans 3:23. Most familiar statement there, but again, probably as well to turn back to it. Verse 23 in chapter 3 of Romans, where Paul writes, "For all sinned and fall short, tes doxes tu theou." All fall short of the glory, the doxa, of God. You see, some commentators have taken this to mean that all come short of reflecting the glory of God, that is, of conformity to His image. And that last sentence was actually a quotation. It's a quotation from John Murray's commentary on Romans, where he sees the reference to falling short of the doxa of God as just another way of saying that all fall short of the icon of God. Remember what we saw in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 7, where the image is linked with the glory of God. The icon of God, the doxa of God, they are linked there in 1 Corinthians 11, 7. Sandy and Headlam in the International Critical Commentary on Romans take the same interpretation of Romans 3, 23. Now, it's perhaps interesting to notice that such a Calvinist commentator on the book of Romans as Charles Hodge rejects that interpretation. He says that doxa here in Romans 3:23 means praise, as it does in John 12:43. They love the praise of men rather than the praise of God. That's the common English translation of John 12:43, but the Greek word there is doxa. To love the doxa of men rather than the doxa of God is to love their praise rather than God's praise. That's the way Hodge reads this. Sinners come short of the praise of God. Whereas Godet, an Arminian commentator on Romans, name spelled G-O-D-E-T, rejects all other interpretations of this verse and gives as the proper interpretation that the glory here spoken of is both that glory which God possesses and that glory of which He is the author or the giver. And so it's that glory that God had originally given man, but now man falls short of it. And except for one distinctively Arminian clause here, Godet's statement of the meaning of Romans 3:23 might well have been written by a Calvinist or a Reformed interpreter. Seems to me a statement much like what Murray's getting at here. As I say, there's one clause here that you wouldn't find in Murray, I don't think, and I'll ask you what that is after I've read it. But let me read the statement. Godet writes, God can communicate this doxa, this glory, because He possesses it Himself, and it belongs to His nature. He had communicated a ray of it to man when He created him, pure and happy. It was intended to shine more and more brightly in man as he rose from innocence to holiness. By sinning, man lost both what he had received of it and what he was yet to obtain. A dispossessed king, the crown has fallen from man's head. Now, what's that one clause there? Yes, Scott. Right. Right, that seems to be saying that man was created in some kind of neutrally innocent position and then he was to come to holy position. And we'll be seeing at a later point, not that much later, a little bit later, that Reformed theology would want to accent that the Scripture teaches that God created man in holiness. But aside from that, as I say, that's a statement of understanding Romans 3:23, much like you would get in Sandy and Headlam or John Murray. Therefore, to sum up, the Scriptures seem to be presenting us with two sets of data, not just one consistent, so it's kind of easy, but two sets of data regarding the relation of fallen man to the image of God, which are contradictory. And that, I think, in no doubt, is at least in large measure the reason why the history of Christian thinking on the topic of the image of God in man presents such a confusing and complex picture. Every historic view of the meaning of the image, you see, is trying to answer that apparent contradiction in the biblical data. And in trying to do that, every historic view propounds its own definition of the image. So let's look at what I'm calling capital B on the outline now, at proposed solutions to the apparent contradiction that we're presented with by the biblical data themselves. Now, of course, there's only a limited number of solutions possible, basically. There's not a great number of ways to go, at least basically. One may affirm that fallen man is still the image of God. That's the truth. And then go on to try to find a way to handle that second group of texts that I referred to now that say man's no longer the image of God. Try to find a way to handle that group of texts that will allow us to say that they aren't teaching As a matter of fact, that man is no longer in God's image. No, the Bible statement is man is still the image of God. That's one way to go. Another way to go is, of course, the very opposite, is to affirm that fallen man is not the image of God any longer. And then try to find a way to interpret that first group of texts so that they are seen not to be teaching that fallen man is still God's image. And then the third possibility, obviously, you guessed it, is to say that fallen man is, in a certain sense, God's image still, and is at the same time, in a certain sense, not God's image any longer. And then what that approach is going to have to do is explain what those two senses are. In one sense, the answer is yes, man is still the image of God. In another sense, the answer is no, he's no longer the image of God. Now you see, in the historic stream of theological views here, the classic Pelagian, Roman Catholic, and Arminian views have this in common, that they all insist that man is still God's image. That's the fundamental truth to be seen. Pelagian, Roman Catholic, Arminian. That doesn't mean they're saying it precisely the same way and the views are the same. I'm just saying they have that in common. They all say man is still the image of God. That's what we must say. The classic Lutheran view, on the other hand, which Birkhauer also seeks now to support, I put it that way because obviously Birkhauer is not Lutheran, he's Reformed. And we usually think of this view as the Lutheran view, is that man is not God's image any longer, period. The traditional Lutheran view. And then the traditional Reformed position is to insist that fallen man both is and is not the image of God in different senses. So let's just look quickly at each of those views in turn. First of all, now we're on Arabic 1 under capital B under Roman 2. According to Pelagius and his followers, the image consisted merely in this: that man was endowed with reason so that he could know God. And man was given free will so that he was able to choose and do the good. And man was given the necessary power to rule the lower creation. And fallen man has not lost the image thus defined, defined in terms of reason, free will, and dominion. Most Arminians take a similar view of the image of God. Some early Arminians echoed the Socinian view. If you know anything about Socinianism, soon after the Reformation, Unitarian, and other false views, some early Arminians echoed the Socinian view that the image of God consists in man's dominion over the lower creation, in accordance with Genesis 1:26, and in that only. That's what being the image of God means, to have dominion over the lower creation. Roman Catholicism distinguished between different gifts that man received. Distinguished between the... And I need another transparency here. I'm going to get so confused with a number of them today, I'm afraid. Distinguished between the so-called natural gifts given to man of spirituality and freedom and rationality on the one side, and the supernatural gifts of original righteousness which speaks of immortality, integrity, and sanctity. Those supernatural, super-added gifts. And here's where Latin phrase seems to come in that everybody knows. There are places where, you know, that's true. Those dona super adata, super added gifts. Or if you want to think of them in the collective as that original righteousness package, you can use the singular and speak of the donum super adatum, the super added gift of original righteousness. But in my sentence, in my notes, I have it in the plural, so let me start it again. These gifts, these super-added, supernatural gifts, were lost in the fall. However, the dona naturalia, the natural gifts, the original constitution of man, they were not lost. And it's this original constitution of man which is the image of God. So although the superadded gifts have been lost because of the fall, the image of God isn't lost, because the image of God is the Bible's way of referring to those natural gifts that man received. Sometimes this distinction was expressed in Roman Catholic thinking in terms of the distinction being between the image and the likeness. Remember I talked about that distinction and said there really isn't any basis to see any distinction in those biblical terms, but sometimes it's been put that way so that the image was taken as the label for the natural endowments, that which is not lost, and the likeness was seen as a biblical label for the supernatural, superadded endowments of original righteousness, that which was lost. And so there's that important distinction. Now it would be too much to say that Roman Catholics said that the image of God was completely unaffected by the fall. Nevertheless, essentially the teaching of Rome was that this image was fully retained. The image fully retained, because man's being the image of God is understood as referring to his possession of these natural gifts, spirituality, freedom, rationality. Going back to the other transparency, and there it is. We look secondly then at the Lutheran approach to this question of what it means that man is the image. The classic Lutheran doctrine, found for example in the Formula of Concord, is that the divine image consisted solely of those spiritual excellencies that man possessed in Eden. And those spiritual excellencies would be seen as spelled out for us by the Apostle Paul in the text we looked at, Colossians 3:10, Ephesians 4:24, in terms of the virtues of knowledge, righteousness, true holiness. That's what the divine image consists of, and therefore man has lost the image of God entirely. Fallen man is indeed still man, but he's no longer the image of God. I said that's the classic Lutheran position. That was the position of Luther himself. Now coming down to the traditional Reformed understanding, which goes back to Calvin himself. This is to insist that we must distinguish between two aspects from which the divine image may be viewed. We have to say that we must look at the divine image from two different perspectives. Viewed from the broader aspect, that image must be seen to be something which is unlosable. Unlosable, something which is inherent in the very nature of man as man. But viewed from the narrower aspect, it must be seen as something which was losable. And not just losable, as something which in fact was lost. In the fall. Now that distinction has been expressed in theology by men using different pairs of contrasting terms according to which pair appeals to a theologian or which pair then appeals to another theologian. And so I put those on the transparency there. They all mean essentially the same thing. They're just different ways of expressing this idea that we have to see that the image of God can be perceived in two different ways, so to speak. Broader image versus narrower image, more narrow image. Man's essence versus man's nature, or his substance versus his accidents, if you want to be very Aristotelian about it. The imago essentialis versus the imago existentialis. The essential image versus the existential image. The formal image versus the material image. Those are the terms that Emil Brunner uses in his book on man. Formal image versus material image. And then coming down to the ones that I use usually, these last two pairs. Moral capacity versus moral conformity. Or perhaps moral agency versus moral excellence. However you want to label them. The distinction is summarized by John Laidlaw in this way, and I quote, In the former sense, the image of God stands for the essence of the soul endowed with the faculty of knowing and willing, the general congruity and analogy between the nature of God and the nature of man, and man's dominion over the creatures. In the latter sense, the image of God stands for that moral conformity to God which man lost by the fall. Now, if you didn't get all that, that's fine, because I want to look at both of those aspects. We'll be saying it in more detail. But just to sum up again, and this is the way I guess I put it on this transparency under the traditional Reformed view. Better put it up higher. Fallen man has lost moral conformity to God, but has not lost moral capacity. But as I say, let's take a look at each of those aspects in turn, and we'll try that transparency. Under the Reformed view of the Imago Dei, to consider first of all a little bit more fully what Reformed theologians have had in mind when they've spoken of the image of God in terms, first of all, more broadly, as some would use the word, I'm not sure how helpful that adverb is, in terms of moral agency. And this is on the outline, small a, under Arabic 3. This matter of moral agency consists in all that which sets man off above all other creatures. All that that makes man a person. This would include man's rationality. For example, in more modern times, man's use of language would be emphasized, his particular way of using language. His freedom, and by that term, of course, we simply would mean here the fact that man is self-moved. He's not simply a creature of instinct who does what is built into him, programmed, so to speak. No, man makes decisions, and he acts on the basis of those decisions that he makes. He wills and acts on that basis. In that sense, even fallen man continues to be a free agent. He continues to act on the basis of his volitions, based on his decisions. And if at any time he's not acting that way, then we say he's not responsible for it. Now, we're going to be discussing that matter of man's freedom much more at the very end of the term, but just to mention it as part in Reformed thinking of what it means to be the image of God. And then it would include also man's responsibility for his actions, his responsibility for what he does. The fact that in his actions, man is never amoral, non-moral. He lives all the time in the realm of ought. And his conscience keeps reminding him of that fact. Immanuel Kant, remember, the way he talked about that categorical imperative of duty he couldn't get away from. Nothing in his way of looking at the phenomenal world gave any rationale for his ought to do this, ought not to do that. After all, there's no freedom in that world, so what sense could he make out of that? But he couldn't get away from it, so he had to postulate another realm, the noumenal realm. Now, of course, fallen man may judge right to be wrong, and he may like to think that wrong is right. We're not getting into that. The point here is simply the fact that he always makes moral judgments. They might be the wrong ones, but he's making moral judgments. And then finally, under my list here, his religiosity. Man's religiosity. The fact that he is not only a creature, but he's a self-conscious creature. Down deep, he knows that he's not self-explanatory. He's dependent. He may try to hide that fact from himself, but because really it's very difficult to hide the fact that one has needs that one can't meet for oneself, one is dependent, man would seem to be indestructibly religious. Now, man cannot know communion with God until he's regenerated by the Holy Spirit. We have to always keep in mind that that change of regeneration and sanctification consists in the redirecting, the reorienting of man's will and his reason and his emotions, everything that you want to label as that which makes up man's personality, his personhood. That change of the new birth is not a metaphysical change. It's not a matter of giving man a new religious propensity or capacity that he didn't have before. It's not giving man now a will on the basis of which he can make decisions that are ethical, that are moral decisions that he's responsible for. He's had that. Man is by nature, even as fallen, a religious being made for communion with God. A moral being responsible for his actions. So regeneration is not to be conceived of as some kind of change in his nature in that sense, in that metaphysical sense, but is rather now an orienting of his faith away from that which he's trusting in and he shouldn't be trusting in. It's an orienting of his love away from that which he's loving, if you will, but he's not to love that. He's to love God with all his heart and soul and mind and strength. It's that kind of reorienting. Now, in making that point, which I'm going to be mentioning again and again now, between now and the end of the term, I guess, because it's such a very significant point in our doctrine of man, in making that point that the fall worked an ethical change in man and not a metaphysical change in man, and therefore that what is needed for his restoration is likewise an ethical, not a metaphysical change, in making that point, theologians that you will read talking about man often call attention, because it seems to help, seems to be convenient or whatever. Attention is called to the teaching of one Flaccius Illyricus, who was condemned by the Lutheran, notice, not Calvinist, but the Lutheran formula of Concord, because he was a Lutheran, whose teaching was that the fall worked a corruption of man's essence or substance. The fall worked somehow a change in the very substance of man, a metaphysical change. And for that teaching, Flaccius Illyricus was condemned by the formula of Concord, and the poor fellow gets picked on over and over again by Berkauer in your reading and by Hodge and so on. Everybody says, there's the exhibit of the fellow who went the wrong way. Now, actually, Flaccius's motivation seems to have been commendable. What he was trying to do, it seems, was that he was trying to resist the growing influence of synergism in the Lutheran Church. You know, in Lutheran theology, through Melanchthon and others, the growing attraction to an idea that goes counter to the sovereign grace of salvation and brings in the idea that God does his part and man does his part. And Flaccius wanted nothing to do with that. And therefore, he wanted to show how serious was the fall and how totally dependent man is on outside help. But nevertheless, in doing that, it seems as though he used language so intemperate as to be accused of falling into the Manichaean error of saying that now man somehow is allied with darkness to the extent that he's no longer man, if you will. Sounds so he could hardly have said that, but that's the kind of thing he's accused of saying, at least. And if you're interested in reading more about that figure in theological history, you could look up in Berkauer's book, Man, the Image of God. He talks about that Lutheran controversy, because this was a controversy within the Lutheran group, you see. He talks about that beginning on page 129. Berkauer, page 129 and following. But now to repeat then, man retains his humanity. In that sense, he continues to be the image of God. That the Reformed theology would want to emphasize. But his humanity is totally misdirected. Totally misdirected. That's what makes it so serious, this business of his sin. Murray writes in your reading assignment on page 39, man is characterized in his fallen state by understanding, feeling, and conscience. He's talking about the same kinds of things. His language is a little different. Understanding, feeling, conscience. And therefore, you see, if I may just insert this parenthetically, he doesn't need to be given understanding, feeling, and conscience in the new birth. He has that. Going on with Murray. But his understanding is darkened, his emotions are perverted, his will is enslaved, and his conscience distorted. He's still that man created with the capacity for being in communion with God and walking according to God's ways. But he's now the man whose understanding is darkened, emotions perverted, will enslaved, and conscience distorted. Now, the importance of all this lies in the fact that although man is fallen, he is still man. He's not an animal, hasn't become a demon. And that's the very reason why we can speak of him as being depraved. Because, you see, only a morally responsible creature can be depraved. We don't speak about a man-eating tiger who's gone into a village and had lunch or whatever. We don't speak of that kind of a ravenous tiger as depraved, for example. We shouldn't if we're being technically accurate. And that's also not only why man can be spoken of as depraved, because he's that kind of creature, a person made the image of God. This is also why man can be saved. Man was so constituted originally as to be capable of receiving revelation from God. He was made so that he could enjoy communion with God. And it's because he retains his original constitution, in the sense that we're speaking of it now under point A, moral agency. It's for that reason that man today, fallen man, even Skid Row man, even the West Aryan Aborigine, let's say, and if you've seen films about that society, it seems so primitive as to raise questions about the hope of missionary activity, let's say. The poorest peasant in Haiti, the most vicious criminal, whatever example you want to give. It's for this reason that man, as long as he's man, even in those distorting circumstances, is capable of receiving regeneration, capable of enjoying reconciliation and restoration of his communion with God. Now, of course, I need to say, even before we break for lunch, so that I'm not misunderstood, that the companion truth to this, of course, and here we're anticipating our discussion of point B, that which was lost as a result of the fall, the companion truth to this is that although man has not lost the capacity for likeness to God and fellowship with God, he has lost, and totally lost, the ability of himself to recover it. And for this, he is now wholly dependent upon a Redeemer who has come in man's own nature. He can't do a thing of himself to be restored to that communion and that likeness to God. He's totally dependent upon that incarnate one who has become man and the grace that's found in him. Now, let me just add a footnote. I'm trying to reach a certain point, and I said yesterday, for some reason, first hour always goes to 12:35, whether I start on time or start a little late, as I did today. It just seems to go that way. The retention of his personality, his manhood, his moral agency, should not be construed, it seems to me, as a gift of God's common grace. Sometimes you might hear it expressed this way, that it's an aspect of the doctrine of common grace, which I'm not going to try to get into now. You know, I do that in the Holy Spirit course at the beginning of it, just because there seems to be time there. And I always say it ought to be taken up in the Doctrine of Man course, but I've never found time for it here. But if you stick with things, you'll get it in the Holy Spirit course. But it's sometimes suggested that this business of man still being moral agent is an aspect of God's common grace. I don't think that's accurate, because even in the state of final perdition, final damnation, man will still retain his manhood, his personality. Only as such a personality could he suffer perdition, damnation. As long as man remains man, he remains the image of God in the sense that we're talking about it now. And you see, we cannot suppose that there's any grace in final perdition. Whether saving grace or what has been labeled common grace, it's the very definition of final condemnation that there is no grace. But that doesn't mean man will no longer be man, no longer a person, no longer a moral agent. And so I don't think it would be accurate to say that this business is part of the truth of common grace. Now, the fact that classic Lutheran theology and even Reformed theologians like Skilder and Burkhauer, The fact that they deny that fallen man is the image of God does not mean, of course, that they deny that man is still man. That would be a straw man to say that's what they're teaching. It doesn't mean that they say that man is no longer possessed of the qualities of personhood. Of course they don't affirm that man is now simply an animal. However, the Reformed objection to such positions is that the Scriptures assert that fallen man is the divine image. Man as man is the divine image. And therefore, that must be an important assertion, and it's impossible to conceive what constitutes that image. At least it's impossible to most Reformed people to understand what constitutes that image if it's not this very personhood of man. You see, it might be thought that the difference between the Lutheran and the Reformed positions that I've just quickly outlined here is, after all, simply a semantic difference. It's just a matter of your theological vocabulary. It's just a matter of what labels you want to use, so it's not of any significance. Reformed theology, however, has felt that there can be serious consequences. Man, because he is man, is the divine image. And Reformed theology has believed that that is all important to an understanding of sin and of righteousness. It's just the fact that he is God's image that makes the matter of his sin such a grave matter. He's using all his personhood given to him so that he might be God's covenant partner, using all his being, so to speak, in his rebellion against his Creator. That's what makes that rebellion such a serious matter. Now, Reformed theology has asked, therefore, may it not be that where there is a denial of man's continued role specifically as image of God, as there is that denial in Lutheran theology, may there not, along with that then, come a certain tendency to underestimate the gravity of man's sin? Now this is very interesting, of course, thinking ahead, because Burkhard is going to say the problem with the Reformed view is that it leads to an underestimation of the gravity of man's sin. But nevertheless, that's later. I'll talk about that later. Now I'm saying it from the Reformed perspective. John Murray, for example, on page 45 of your assigned reading, John Murray suggests that there may be a close relationship between the Lutheran position regarding the image, namely that fallen man is not the image of God, a close relationship between that doctrine and the Lutheran avoids either the one-sidedness of Calvinism, in his view, or the synergism of Arminianism, which he certainly wants to deny. He does that with his doctrine of non-resistance, which is... Right, which is the doctrine that although God's omnipotent power is always at work where the Word comes, whether that Word comes in preaching or in the sacrament, while God's almighty power is always at work with the Word, nevertheless, as Dale says, sinful man may resist that power. And indeed, that's why he is not converted. Now you see, that doctrine, certainly from Murray's perspective, from a Calvinist perspective, seems to involve, clearly, a defective view of man's depravity. Because the depraved man's inevitable reaction to God's grace is going to be to offer resistance. When the good news is presented to the rebel against God, his inevitable reaction is going to be to turn away from that good news. And Murray would say, if you don't see that, you haven't seen what the sinner is yet. And it was Murray's contention, and you get into that on page 45, as I say, that the higher the view entertained of the character of man's moral agency, the higher view being the one that sees man's moral agency as an image of God's personality, the higher the view of man's moral agency, the more radically serious will one see the depravity of man to be. As we then see man employing this very divine imageness in the service of his rebellion against God. Now, just one last word before we take the break. The Reformed insistence upon an aspect of the divine image which is inalienable, unlosable, does not mean that that which is inalienable is unaffected by the fall. We must never think of man's personhood in abstraction from the purpose for which he was created as this person, image of God. A moral agent never exercises his moral agency rightly except in whole-souled service to God. So that although man continues to be characterized, if we use kind of the old-fashioned wording, by intellect, feeling, and will, even in the fallen state, he does not have them in their proper exercise. They are, as we've already said, but now we're emphasizing again, they are distorted by sin. We must never abstract man's metaphysical makeup, man's nature, from his moral obligation to God. So his whole being has been distorted by sin, and we're not wanting to deny that when we talk about his still being the image of God in this sense, that he remains a moral agent. And that leads us naturally into our discussion of point B on the outline, which is the image viewed in terms of moral excellence. And you'll notice, if you are an outliner, that the outline's a little crazy here, or whatever. The outline begins to turn back on itself, notice, at this point. We're under Arabic 3, the Reformed view of man, the image of God. That's under capital B, proposed solutions to the apparent contradiction in the biblical data. But now that we want to state the Reformed view of man's original excellence, this is going to make it very convenient for us to go on to state the other theological positions concerning man's original condition. And so I've noted on the outline that we're going to begin now with the Reformed view of man's original moral excellence, even though you see we're under point three, which is the Reformed view. Okay, getting back into things again then, if man was created in a divine image that is to be defined in terms of knowledge and righteousness and holiness, that's not going to be over far enough, is it? And now I'm just recalling the discussion of the key text there, Colossians 3:10, Ephesians 4:24. If that's true, then we must appreciate what this means. Because knowledge in the Scripture means not merely a capacity for knowing, it means conscious understanding of the truth. When the Bible talks about having knowledge, it means having a real understanding of the truth, not just a capacity for that. And since all truth has its source and meaning in God, knowledge of the truth, true knowledge, is knowledge of God. Righteousness in the Bible means far more than merely being free from wrongdoing, not having sins against one's account. Righteousness in the Bible means positive conformity to the divine will. It's a wonderfully positive concept, not simply the mere absence of disobedience, but the positive attribute of obedience. And holiness in the Bible carries both the meaning of consecration, separation to God, and possession of that moral purity which characterizes God, which separates God from all sin. To have holiness, then, is to have moral purity. So if man was created in the divine image, and if that image is defined in these terms, that means that man originally did not have to attain to knowledge, to righteousness, to holiness. He already possessed these qualities as created endowments. In other words, Adam was not merely neutrally innocent, as affirmed by Pelagianism, and usually affirmed by Arminianism, and affirmed in the Scofield Reference Bible, page 5, note 5, old original Scofield, and other dispensationalists. No, he wasn't just neutrally innocent. Adam was created positively holy. And that truth would seem to be implied in that early statement there in Genesis, the first chapter, and verse 31. And God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was tov meod. It was very good. Now, what does it mean to be very good? It would seem that that description, as it is applied to each created thing, must be given a connotation, must be given a meaning in each case that is relevant to the specific character of that created thing. To be very good is to be what God has created that to be. It's to be that whatever in its proper fulfillment. Every creature was very good in terms of its own particular sphere, purpose, character, and function. Just think of the varying connotations of very good as used to describe a river, or if you would use that phrase to describe a rose or a rabbit, trying to get alliteration here. Every created being has its own sphere, its own function, its own purpose, if you will, its own character. Now, man is a rational, moral, religious being. Applied to man, therefore, very good can only mean that he was very good rationally. Knowledge comes in again. And he was very good morally and very good religiously. Paul talks about righteousness and holiness. In other words, I'm suggesting that that phrase, though it's a kind of a general statement, or however you want to describe it there, in Genesis 1:31, would seem to be right in line with Paul's indicators there in his letters. A very good man has knowledge, righteousness, and holiness. And in this connection, another verse that has often seemed to be to this point is in Ecclesiastes 7:29. That's where we read, "Behold, I have found only this, that God made man yashar." God made man yashar, usually translated, if we're going to be kind of literal, upright. God made man upright, but they have sought out many devices. Now, this probably goes without my saying it, but don't fall into the rather silly error of letting the English translation cause you to think that the reference is to man's carriage, physical posture. God created man to walk on his hind legs or whatever. Obviously, that's not what upright means. The ethical force of that term, yashar, is clear throughout the Old Testament. And I've listed some texts there. I don't know why they got way down there. But there are some texts that make that clear. For example, we read in Hosea 14, verse 9, in the Hebrew, it's verse 10, that God's ways are yasharim. They are right. God's ways are upright, yasharim. And the righteous, the zadokim, will walk in them. And in Deuteronomy 32:4, you read that God is zadik and yashar. God is righteous and upright. That's God. And the term is used of men in such places as Micah 7, verse 2. The godly person has perished from the land, and there is no upright person, yashar, no upright among men. And finally, Job 1:1, Job is that man who was blameless, Tom, upright, yashar, fearing God, turning away from evil. And so, Franz Delitzsch writes on that passage in his commentary on Ecclesiastes on page 334 and 5, this, and I quote, "The expression here, God has made man yashar, is dogmatically significant." Dogmatically, that is theologically important. "Man, as he came from the Creator's hand, was not placed in the state of moral decision, nor yet in the state of absolute indifference between good and evil. He was not neither good nor bad, but he was tov." He's thinking in Genesis 1:31, though he doesn't mention the text. "He was good, he was tov, or," which is the same thing, "he was yashar. That is, in every respect, normal, so that he could normally develop himself from this positively good foundation." Not just neutral, Delitzsch says, but positively good. Now, maybe I should mention just in passing here, in case you come across it, as I hope you will be reading the Westminster Confession of Faith, and you say, "Now, wait a minute, that sounds like what was called the Pelagian or Arminian approach," when Westminster says in the Confession of Faith in chapter 9, paragraph 2, "Man in his state of innocency," Man in his state of innocency is spoken of there. But just notice how that sentence goes on to speak of man having, quote, freedom and power to will and to do that which was good and well-pleasing to God. And in chapter 4, section 2, 4:2, Westminster describes man as created this way, endued with knowledge, righteousness, and true holiness. And chapter 6, section 2, speaks of our first parents, quote, original righteousness and communion with God. And therefore, I think it's perfectly accurate not to think that the confession in speaking of man's state of innocency has in mind some bare, neutral, passive innocency. He doesn't have anything against his record yet, but is using that word in a more positive sense. He is innocent, he is pure, what have you. I think if you look at it in the context of the whole confession, that is clear enough. John Calvin in the Institutes, and there's that reference on the transparency, 2:1, 10 and 11, says this, and this is a truth that Calvin enunciates more than once. I think it's worth reading this, though it's fairly lengthy. Let me read from the Institutes here, 2:1, 10 and 11. Let us accordingly remember to impute our ruin to depravity of nature in order that we may not accuse God himself, the author of nature. True, this deadly wound clings now to nature, but it is a very important question whether the wound has been inflicted from outside or whether it has been present from the beginning. It is evident that the wound was inflicted through sin. We have, therefore, no reason to complain except against ourselves. Scripture has diligently noted this fact, for Ecclesiastes says, "This I know, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many devices." Chapter 7, verse 29. Obviously, man's ruin is to be ascribed to man alone. For he, having acquired righteousness by God's kindness, has by his own folly sunk into vanity. Therefore, we declare that man is corrupted through natural vitiation, but a vitiation that did not flow from nature. We deny that it has flowed from nature in order to indicate that it is an adventitious quality which comes upon man rather than a substantial property which has been implanted from the beginning. And yet we do call it natural, in order that no man may think that anyone obtains it through bad conduct, since it holds all men fast by hereditary right. Our usage of that term natural is not without authority. The Apostle states, Ephesians 2:3, we are all by nature children of wrath. How could God, who is pleased by the least of his works, have been hostile to the noblest of all his creatures? He is hostile, however, toward the corruption of his work rather than toward the work itself. End of the quote. You see, Calvin's wrestling with that fact that we talk about the natural man. And that could give somebody the idea that we mean that's the way man's always been kind of thing. And he says it's now natural to man because of man's choice of sin. But as God created him, he was created righteous. And Calvin says that's important because we must never lay any of the blame for our sinful situation upon God. Any suggestion that God is author of sin is out, says Calvin. Now you see, therefore, why the fall of man was so serious. It was not simply failure to attain, it was apostasy from that which was given. Adam forfeited what he possessed, as well, of course, as forfeiting what he was promised. And I hope we can see the theological importance of the doctrine of man's original righteousness. The question of the meaning of the divine image in which man was created involves us inevitably, you see, in this question: what was man's condition before his fall? And I hope we see that that's not merely some speculative kind of question that we ask simply to satisfy our curiosity. No, it's been viewed as a very important theological question, because we realize how important the doctrine of the fall of man is, all the implications that's going to have. But we can never appreciate the nature of the fall until we appreciate that from which man fell. And I'll be putting that in kind of visual form on a transparency in just a minute. But I should have handed this out maybe before now. Let's get it started around. Here's a tabulation that John Murray used to share in class. And then I can remember him becoming very, he's always very serious. How did he ever become more serious? But anyway, seemingly even more serious and characteristically kind of shaking his head and saying, gentlemen, memorize those truths. There's a world of theology in that chart. Get that and you've got a world of theology behind you that will have implications all along the way. Anyway, let's look at what we have in this kind of a tabulation of these truths. Looking at the Reformed view, moral agency is conceived of, naturally enough, as concreated and natural to man. That old word concreated simply means this came along with his creation. He didn't have to attain to this. He didn't get this tacked on later in some way, superadded. Being a moral agent was concreated, was part of his being, concreated and natural to man. In the same way, so also, moral excellence was concreated, you see, as Reformed understanding is, not superadded, and therefore we should say it was natural. Not that man somehow achieved it, it's God's gift, but nevertheless it was natural, concreated, not supernatural. And let me just say here in kind of a footnote again, a parenthesis, that Calvin in the Institutes 224, and similar statements are found in sections 12 and 16, 224, 12, 16. Calvin cites with favor Augustine's statement. Augustine's statement that man's natural gifts were corrupted, and his supernatural gifts were taken away. So Calvin quotes Augustine approvingly, putting it that way. But I think we certainly do better to avoid that qualifier, supernatural gifts. I think it's bound to lead to a Roman Catholic kind of misunderstanding. So here's one of those places where we do better not to follow Calvin. There aren't many, but there are some. So as I say, moral agency and moral excellence, both concreated and natural to man, and the divine image in which man was created has reference, notice on this tabulation, both to man's moral agency and to his right employment of it, moral excellence. Man's being the image of God has reference to both aspects of the truth, shall we say, that he is a person with all that means. And that he is the one who reflects God's own moral purity. Now, that seemed to be, as I say, a convenient place to then look, though it's a little crazy in outlining, at other historic views of man's original condition. Okay, so we'll move on the outline here to two in brackets. We're under B, moral excellence. One in brackets is the Reformed doctrine. And now two as the parenthesis, two in brackets, other historic views of man's original condition. Starting there, we'll have this as A in brackets with the Lutheran view. And that's all we want to see there. We go back to this. Now, on the Lutheran view, again, moral agency is seen to be concreated, natural to man. And also moral excellence, both moral agency and moral excellence, concreated and natural. Remember again Delitzsch's comments on Ecclesiastes 7:29. And Delitzsch is a Lutheran, and he's affirming, as a Lutheran, the righteousness, uprightness, morally, as God created man. Here, however, the divine image is viewed as having reference only to man's original moral excellence. And calling man the image of God has no reference, the Lutheran says, to anything that was unlosable. Being the image of God only references being in moral conformity to God's law. Okay, another view of man's original condition, of course, the Roman Catholic view, and on the outline this is B in brackets. In the Roman Catholic view, moral agency was concreated and natural. And the divine image consisted of this, and it was not lost. But now the difference comes in this theology in seeing moral excellence, however, as superadded and supernatural, a donum superadditum. As created, whoops, other transparency, gives me something to do, that's for sure. As created, man was composed of two elements, if you will, body and soul. Two distinct, diverse, different entities, body and soul. The one, the body, with lower impulses, corporeal impulses, sensual impulses. The other, the soul, knowing the higher exercises of reason and conscience and will. So that in man's lower nature, there was already, at creation, at the first, the fuel, the potentiality of sin. This is spoken of in Roman theology with that long word, concupiscence. Concupiscence, which is defined in the volume, The Teaching of the Catholic Church, edited by George D. Smith, volume 1, page 328, this way. Concupiscence is a natural effect of man's dual nature. The natural effect of man's having two kinds of appetites, not just one, two kinds of appetites, sensitive and rational. Now, we don't use that word sensitive in that sense, but I think it's clear enough what is meant has relation to our senses, physical appetites, that kind of thing, the sensual. Concupiscence is the natural effect of man's dual nature, of his having two kinds of appetites, sensitive and rational. But this concupiscence means that there was a discordancy, discord, tendency to conflict between those two aspects of man's being. Or, as Robert Bellarmine, the theologian of the Counter-Reformation, as the Roman Catholic theologian Robert Bellarmine was willing to speak of it, not merely at the beginning a tendency to conflict, but conflict. This discordancy, this conflict, or at least the tendency to conflict, created the necessity, right there at the beginning, the necessity for the bestowal of a donum superadditum, a gift by which man was, quoting, exalted above human nature and made participant in the nature of God. You get that quotation in Murray's writings there in volume 2 on page 42. There was a necessity because of this in-created conflict for a donum superadditum to keep things in balance. And that is the gift of original righteousness. See, we're really getting clever now. We even have overlays, which leaves it so you can't read it anymore. But the original righteousness is superadded. I just superadded it. And keeps things the way they should be. Keeps the harmony as it should be. Now, it was that original righteousness, that superadded gift, that was lost in the fall. So that man's back there again and is restored in the process of salvation. It's the restoration of that righteous situation, harmony again, that the means of grace are working toward. Now, Bellarmine, of course, had a certain gift for stating things baldly, without a lot of nuance, and that makes him one that's convenient to cite for traditional Counter-Reformation Roman Catholic theology because he puts it forward very clearly, but really is stating what seems to be the thrust of the teaching when he says that that integrity with which the first man was created, that integrity, and without which after his fall all men are now born, was not his natural condition, you see, say it again, but a supernatural endowment. Because man naturally consists of flesh and bones, he therefore has community of nature partly with the beasts, though also has community of nature with the angels. By reason of the body, man has sensual desires and appetites, even though by reason of the soul, he has propensity to spiritual good. But because those two propensities have between them a certain battle, from that inherent battle, there arises difficulty now in doing good, because the original righteousness gift is no longer there. Now, what Catholics see to be at stake in this whole debate with the Reformed and Lutheran theology, why they think this is very important, is revealed in this passage from that volume, The Teaching of the Catholic Church, which presents a very traditional Roman Catholic theology, each chapter written by different writer. In The Teaching of the Catholic Church, edited by George D. Smith, volume 1, page 326, the importance of the difference here on your tabulation again between the Reformed view and the Lutheran view, you could link those together now, and the Roman Catholic view on the other side is said to be this, and I'm quoting, volume 1, page 326. Its importance lies in this, that if Adam's endowments were natural, the way the Reformers see it, then since by his sin he lost them, both for himself and us, it will then follow that man's nature now is intrinsically and essentially vitiated by being deprived of some elements originally proper to it. His nature will therefore be in itself now an evil thing. But if, on the other hand, these endowments were something given to Adam over and above, over and above all that went to make up his full manhood, then it follows that in spite of their loss, human nature remains complete, in essence unimpaired by original sin, intrinsically whole and good in itself. I hope you follow that. I kind of lost my place there for a minute, because that's not Robert Bellarmine writing. That's this volume, which is viewed as just a very typical statement of traditional Roman Catholic theology, And note how it ends up, is that if this original righteousness were a superadded gift, whenever I hear that term, donum superadditum, I picture Dr. Van Til, who often referred to this whole issue here because he thought it was so important. And he would always strut before us in class picturing a man wearing, for some reason, he always said, a derby hat. Why it was a derby, I don't know, but that's the kind of hat, I guess, from his youth he always pictured. And somebody coming along and knocking his hat off. Van Til would always try to illustrate the Catholic teaching this way. That original righteousness is that superadded gift, and even when it gets knocked off, you're still the man you were. You know, you're still essentially the same. Well, that's not an exaggeration, I don't think, really, when you read this, that then it follows that in spite of their loss, the gifts of original righteousness, all those gifts, human nature remains complete, in essence unimpaired by original sin, intrinsically whole and good in itself. I also think back to my youth, when for a while a surprisingly popular television figure, you may have heard the name, was Bishop Fulton Sheen. Maybe you've never heard the name. But back in the first days of television, and to amazement, it was written up in the papers and magazines, there was a reasonable number of people who, instead of watching Uncle Mildy and his silliness, began to watch this Roman Catholic bishop, theologian, and writer, who would just stand before the camera, talking head, nothing visual about it at all. Well, the only thing visual was his piercing eyes. He's always known for everybody who looked at the screen felt he was talking to them. Just had tremendously sharp, intelligent, piercing eyes. And what I remember, what I'm leading up to with all that, is the way he would so often come back, and I was just like 9th, 10th grade, but I still remember he'd come back to the point that it's Roman Catholic Christianity that teaches the dignity of man again. And it's those bad guys, those Protestants, who so teach about the fall that man's character, using the words there, is vitiated and is really kind of demonic and so on. But we don't believe that in the Catholic Church. We believe that in spite of the fall, man is essentially what he was as he comes from the hand of the Creator. as it says here, unimpaired by original sin, intrinsically whole and good in itself. That is that nature of man. Now, the Protestant objections to such a teaching should be obvious enough to this group, I would hope. I'm just going to list two objections to that view of man's original condition. First of all, that Roman Catholic position presents a degrading view of man's original state as created by his holy God. That's what Calvin was getting at in the quote I read a little bit earlier. It was because of this teaching of the church that Calvin goes back to that point at several points and says, don't slander the Creator. With the idea that there was, in Bellarmine's terms, a disease, a languor in man's natural state, which needed a remedy. Again, here was man's natural state as he comes from the hand of the Creator up there at the top. There's a conflict at work there, and he needs that superadded gift. That is, as I say, to not do justice to the Creator's righteous creation. And then secondly, that same position, Roman Catholic position, presents a falsely optimistic, too low a view of man's original condition, and too high a view, a falsely optimistic view of man's fallen state. And here's the way Bellarmine wrote about that in rather striking terms, and I quote, for this whole quotation in Latin, you can see Charles Hodge, volume 2, page 104, if there are any purists in the group. But I'll read it in English. The state of man after the fall differs no more from the state of man in natural purity, in puris naturalibus, than a man originally naked differs from one who was once clothed but has been stripped of his clothing. Nor is human nature in any lower state, leaving out of account the original fall, nor does it labor now under greater ignorance or infirmity than it was and labored under as created in natural purity. You take two men, Bellarmine says. You think about them. The one's naked. The other man used to have very lovely clothing, but he got stripped of that. Now he's naked. Essentially, those two men don't differ. Neither is there any essential difference, says Bellarmine, between that original man before the superadded gift and that man now who has been stripped of that supernatural gift. By the way, don't get into asking the question, when did the gift get added? Catholics aren't concerned about that. Probably added in second one of the first day or something. It's not that they're trying to talk about some long period where you had that situation without the original righteousness. That's not their point. It's not temporality they're concerned about. But whenever it came, it was superadded, even if it was right there at the first instant, if you will. But they want it to be superadded so that man without it will be seen as not lacking anything. That's the point. Yes. Certainly any true wickedness, and we'll be seeing this in a moment, could only be true when wrong motives and desires were given into. Because in the Roman Catholic concept, it's only that yielding to it that would truly be sin, in any case. Well, even that last one on from Bellarmine, nor is human nature in any lower state leaving out of account the original fall. Now, you see, that's kind of put in parenthetically, but that indicates that there's a recognition of the original fault, and the original fault is faulty, so there's something, you know, that's being acknowledged there, though it's very much in passing. Nor is human nature in any lower state leaving out of account the original fault, nor does it labor under greater ignorance or infirmity than it was and labored under as created in natural purity. So the thrust is still definitely on the positive. And I was going to say next here that while, you know, I think we have to recognize, as I already said, Bellarmine's gift for taking traditional Roman Catholic doctrine to, let's say, logical conclusions and making kind of unqualified assertions not every Catholic would make, even traditionally. Still, I think that that is expressing, certainly at least, the tendency, the direction of historic Roman Catholic doctrine. Immediately after the sentences that I quoted there, Bellarmine adds this. This is the universal view. This is the universal view of the subject held by the old schoolmen and by more recent writers. And Shedd makes this comment, Bellarmine's explanation is as authoritative as any individual opinion can be within the papal church.